Uniontown. Uniontown, Fayette County, Pennsylvania. I'm making a start at the notes for you on the place of my birth. I have no idea of how to approach this because there's so much that I might say, and it's much too much, and just how to, what angle I should take is a matter still to be determined. But I thought the best way to do is for me to make a start, and then you could advise me as to what is needed, and I could follow your advice and get underway in that fashion. To begin with, my first very clear recollection is going out to our barn in which we kept a horse, a cow, and a cow. It was rather large for a place in town, and when originally built had been on the edge of the town. My recollection goes back to climbing up the ladder, which was fastened to the side of the barn, in an effort to get to the haymow. The first time I had ever tried this, my brother had gone ahead of me and had disappeared in the haymow, and as I climbed up the ladder, being very cautious and a little frightened, I came to a windowless opening which I could look out of between the rungs of the ladder. In a sense, it seemed to me, my recollection is my first look at the world. A creek ran through our place, and my line of vision went down the line of the creek. And I saw some little distance below me some highly colored ducks swimming about, which of course attracted my eye immediately. There was a dog or two along the bank. There were chickens wandering about. All of it fascinated me, and it seemed a whole world exposed in an instant to my eye. The barn was part of our place. There was also a carriage house and a smaller building. For what purpose, I do not recall. All of this played a very important part in my early life, which I will touch on later. The National Pike, the famous federal road from Cumberland to Wheeling, to connect up the freight line, we might say, from the east by the Baltimore and Ohio Canal to Cumberland, by the great Conestoga wagons from Cumberland to Wheeling, West Virginia, and down the river from Wheeling, and then possibly up the Mississippi, and then again on up the Missouri, and further out, clear into the really far Middle West, I will say. That was the approach. This road, as I said, passed in front of our house. The house was at the one end of a very monumental arch bridge of the type that was common along this national highway. And directly across the street from me was a red brick house in which lived my chum of those days. His name was Andrew Thompson. His father later became a tremendously wealthy man and a great influence in southwestern Pennsylvania, and in a sense a sort of arrival of the Mellon financial structure. However, to get back to me, I don't remember much of the very early days, But as I grew a little older, Andrew Thompson, or Andy as I called him, and myself became inseparable. And we had a delightful country in which to roam. This creek went through our place, and there was a little island, and what we called was an orchard, though it was only composed of four very large apple trees, in which we had the privilege of crawling about all we wanted to, and in which we had a tree house. There was a spring house there, a brick spring house, which was fed by a spring, and there's where the milk and things of that nature were kept. And I can still remember seeing my mother skim the cream from the milk with a long, flat spoon. Against the side of this spring house was a very crude shack built into against the wall, and that was the great place of business of Andy and of me, where we later on ran our restaurants, where we kept rabbits, and two or three other things that I don't recall at the moment. The life was very simple. The country was very beautiful and was very rich in surface farming and in the coal which underlay the region and which eventually destroyed a great deal of its beauty. But it hadn't reached the immediate vicinity of my hometown. And beyond our house stretched some fertile fields and what we call the first and second and third hollows, one of which had a tiny waterfall which fascinated us. And we became curators of all the lizards out of the stream there. Altogether, it was a very charming place for a boy, and we were allowed complete liberty, in a sense, to deface that portion in which we played. To jump across considerably in the time element, I remember when Whitney, I think it was Secretary of the Navy, and they constructed what we called in those days the Great White Fleet. Well, Andy and I built a canal, about 2 inches wide, maybe more, which paralleled the creek bed for quite a lengthy distance. And we whittled out these ships with matches for masts and thread for guys, and constructed the Great White Fleet, and we would sail it down this canal we had made. I recall that because it was very fascinating for a boy, and most of the other boys in town came there in order to participate in this aquatic performance. Incidentally, that region there of our place became quite a playground for most boys because none of them had quite a similar opportunity with a creek and an island and a little orchard and a number of other things of that nature. The trees on the place were very interesting because the man who had built the place some years before, I don't of course remember what that was quite an expert in fruit growing, and he had developed these trees so each one, as most of them, bore two kinds of fruit. I remember our cherry tree, as I recall, had three kinds of cherries, and they didn't all come in at the same season. And I also recall that the stricture on the cherry tree was made by my father. We could climb as much as we pleased to get the cherries, but we must not break off a limb. Well, that was very difficult because lots of the cherries were far out, and ours was always a race with the birds to see who would get the cherries first. There were only one peach tree, but there were a number of pear trees, some very large pears and others rather small, like sickle pears. There was one very fine apple tree. The others were not so good. Altogether, it made a very attractive playground for a boy, and of course that is my main recollection of the place. I'm going to proceed without relation to the orderly development of the story on a time basis. One of these houses on the place, as I explained, was the carriage shed. And the carriage that was in it disappeared after a time because Father had the stable torn down and only the foundation stone left and the lumber all piled up to one side. He thought there was a possibility of selling the stone for the foundation, from the foundation, and also of selling the lumber. Neither of these things occurred. And both areas became the centers of our boy playing and developing. We first started out by building rafts out of the lumber and sailing them down the creek. But the lumber was too large and clumsy and too heavy and too old, and that didn't go very well. But there was a friend of mine, an elderly man, who had lost his great toy store in Pittsburgh and had opened a small store in Uniontown, had his brother make for me a fine flat-bottom boat, and that navigated the lower reaches of this stream. That played a tremendous part in our activities of that day. We ran a ferry and had tickets for the ferry, and while the ferry was only the width of the stream, yet to us it was a very important crossing, and the girls from school would buy tickets from us with pins and pennies and would come down after school to cross over and back on the ferry. We ran the ferry with great formality. My chum would be the engine man and pole it, and I don't remember his costume particularly, but I know I was the conductor as a rule, and I had my mother's punch from the 500 counting business, and that was the card game of that day, and I wore my hat backwards, and I took up the tickets. One of the incidents of my young life that occurred here and made a definite impression upon me was the girls had gone over to the far bank, and now came the return trip. They had these elaborately prepared tickets that we had made by hand, and used a typewriter, a rather primitive machine for children of that day. On the return trip, the girls got obstreperous and refused to give me the tickets. I was terribly humiliated with my cap on backwards and my 500 punch machine in my hand to punch the tickets, and what made it worse was my chum Andy began laughing at me. And here I was with the girls in this flatboat all jeering at me, and with my engineer and boom companion laughing at me, and I was stuck. Just then my eye fastened on a cork in the floor of the boat, which we utilized in draining it. Well, with the inspiration of the moment, I pulled the cork, and under the pressure of the weight of the passengers, this stream of water shot up in the air. All the girls screamed, and I sank the boat in the middle of the stream, and they all had to wade ashore and promise me what their fathers were going to do to me. I've never forgot that, because I had to do something, and I had to think quickly, and what I did set me up again as the temporary master of the situation. And our boat sank in the middle of the stream, and we had to get it to shore later on. Another thing that occurred there that had very interesting aftermaths in looking back on my childhood period was one of these buildings, the carriage house. No, it was the other house, which we established a greenhouse. We had gone with our mothers to the real greenhouse in the outskirts of the town, and we thought the green related to the color of the house. So when we came back, we went to our friend in the carriage shop, who I had to write to when he was 90 years old out on the West Coast in later years, and he gave us the remains of green paint in the cans left from putting the Brewster green on carriages. And we got this out by the little turpentine and painted as much of this house as we could green, and it was therefore a greenhouse. Now we had to raise plants. Well, we had no plants, so we raised weeds and used tin cans painted green as the receptacles in place of flower pots. My father, who had quite a green thumb, happened to look at this greenhouse with much amusement and was much struck with what you could do with a weed if you fertilized it. And of course, there was ample fertilizer available because we had the inside of this stable to dig in, which had the fertilizer of years of the animals that had been in the stable. that it prompted him to suggest to us that we put some real plants in. And he told us we could get seeds and grow them, and we could also get some little plants from the greenhouse. So as I recall, he gave me 75 cents, and I think Andy's father gave him the same thing, or his mother, rather. And we went to the greenhouse. I've always regretted that I never kept track of this man, because he did something that I thought was very, very thoughtful in his dealings with children. We picked around so long that he asked us just what we had in mind. We were looking at the smallest pots he had, because we thought we could get more for the money, and we only had a dollar and a half. And when he heard that we were getting it for our greenhouse and that we were going to be his competitors in business, he gave us quite a large selection of these small pots in order to amplify what we otherwise could have only been able to obtain with our dollar and a half. From then, this greenhouse, as it were, began to grow, and we began planting outside in what had been a little chicken yard in front of it. And finally, we began planting on the side of the old barn. And out of that came a very interesting occurrence. We read in the seed magazine of Peter Henderson and Company an advertisement that there was a new tomato had been developed, and whoever suggested the best name for this tomato would get $50. Well, that is the largest sum of money I think we'd ever heard of at that time. So we sent for the seed and proceeded to plant this and grew the plants. And as they got a little larger, we transplanted them to the stable, not the stable yard, but the actual site of the stable in this very, very rich land. My father showed us how to prune the plants by taking the suckers out between the branches, and we grew these very large tomato plants and further pruned them so we only had a little fruit on each one, and we grew these tremendously large tomatoes. Well, in the first place, we took these downtown to a grocery store and sold them. We got a very small return, but we were very proud of the pennies that we got for these tomatoes. And my father was rather contemptuous of us for selling them so cheaply. Then the grocerman communicated with us, and he wanted more. And on inquiry, we found that one of his richest clients had gotten some of these tomatoes and immediately wanted some duplicates. Well, he didn't have them. We came back and reported that with great glee that our stock was in demand, especially, and particularly by this well-to-do family. My father told us now, he said, "You set the price," and he suggested the first price. Well, the grocer blew up when we gave him the price, because he thought to get them for almost nothing, and we actually put a good price on this large tomato. Well, remembering the advertisement of the Peter Henderson magazine, we took a Kodak of a tomato with a silver dollar leaning against it in order to furnish a scale as to its size. These were the first dollar Kodaks issued by the Eastman Company, and we got a very good picture. And we sent that on to the Peter Henderson Company as our offering in this contest. We suggested the name, two names as a matter of fact, hitched together, and they came back with a reply and thanked us for sending in our piece, and told us that the two names they thought were inadvisable, it ought to be one name. But they wanted to say that that was the largest tomato they had ever seen, and they would like one of our parents to write and describe how that tomato had been raised. They could tell this, they were dealing with children, because we had written all this on our toy typewriter, and was very much a childish offering. I told this to my father, and he was intensely interested in this, and he wrote to Peter Henderson and explained that how this was done, but he observed in finishing that you couldn't tear down a stable every time you wanted to raise a tomato. However, that was our first proud boast, that our tomato had been the largest one that they had ever seen. That was the Ponderosa tomato, which you see advertised of this day. And the man that proposed Ponderosa was the winner of the contest. So a great deal of our life circulated around these buildings that we had at our disposal. Our greenhouse, our other things that we had there. Then we began raising game bantam chickens. And my mother was very much opposed to our fighting game chickens. So we took her out and showed her two game bantam black-breasted red chickens fight. And they were very cute, and they didn't hurt each other, and she thought it was all right. Then after she left, we put the steel spurs on them, which the blacksmith made for us out of horseshoe nails. And now they could walk around in their steel spurs, and then they were dangerous fighters for their size. I remember our prize cock weighed exactly 1 pound, and I can recall that his name was Dinkum, D-I-N-K-U-M. The girls had come down after school to buy our green things, and then I received an education in the what happens in connection with the middleman. We were always exploring the country. We were getting old bones to sell, old iron to sell, and very little rubber because there were no rubber tires much in those days. But we used a pony cart and go all over the countryside, which was open country, right up to our house. Out there, one spring day, we found the side of the hill with a very large plot of blue forget-me-nots. Well, this appealed to us, so we took the spade out of the pony cart, which we always took with us, and spaded up quite a large number of forget-me-nots. And when we got them back to our shop, as it were, we took empty strawberry boxes, and the same as we have today, and cleaned them up, painted them green. Again, the paint came from our friend, the carriage maker, and put a black stripe around them. Then we planted the forget-me-not in them and put moss around the forget-me-not. And then we, during a recess period at school, we hustled home, having gotten permission from our teacher to go a little early, and took these strawberry boxes, green with a black stripe, with the blue forget-me-not and the moss around the top. It was a very attractive-looking little affair, and the girls all bought them. I don't remember what we charged them for them, but it was some infinitesimal sum. Later on, we were having a May Day picnic, and these same girls largely, and they saw this forget-me-not patch out in the country. In fact, we were fool enough to take them near it, to this holla, as we call it, where the waterfall was, which is our favorite playing place in the country. And they saw that we'd gotten these for nothing, and we'd spaded them up out of this plot. They immediately turned on us and thought that we had cheated them, and they boycotted our whole enterprise, and that put the greenhouse out of business. But they gave us no credit for finding the patch, for digging the plants up, for finding the strawberry boxes, for painting them green and black striping them, for getting the moss to go around the plant, for transporting them to school. In other words, all the middleman activities in this thing between the blossoming of the plant and the sale we carried out, and which was responsible for the attractiveness of it, but we were boycotted, and that put us out of the greenhouse. But it also taught me a little bit about the position of the middleman. Attractive. Of course, a boyhood recollection of a place like that is rather difficult to compare to modern recollections. But I always thought it was a charming place to live, and we had great fun out of it. And it largely centered around our yard, which was fairly large. And the creek, of course, was the great jewel of the production. Later on, I might explain some of our activities, which will tell a little bit of boyhood life there. We ran a restaurant in this lean-to we'd constructed against the spring house. And we had it very carefully fixed up with a counter, and then around, rather, to one side of the counter where you couldn't see it from the counter, we had an old stove. And Andy was the cook, and I was the waiter. I valued my job because it allowed me to use the terms that they called out for apple pie and other things like that in the first restaurant of that character in the town. So I would advertise our food in a very loud tone of voice, and the boys could enter this building by crawling in a double entrance. You first went in head first, and then you turned to your right and got out. That was had one door against the cold. There we sold largely sweet potatoes, such apples as were left from the trees, and most everything anointed with sugar. We had a little shaker, I remember, with a little tin handle on it. And the favorite thing we sold were sweet potatoes. We had a strike on the sweet potatoes, and the boys refused to buy them. They said they were no good. And I went back to interview the cook, who had a newspaper representation of a cook's chef's hat, and he protested he was making those sweet potatoes just like they're always made. He said the only thing different was that he'd run out of sugar and he'd put sand in the can. I told him of this in after years, and he resented that story, that he could have been that dumb, but it is actual truth. He afterwards became a millionaire, and he may have sold him some more sand, I don't know. But we had a great deal of fun around this. The rabbit affair was the usual one, with too rapid production and a burring out, getting down under the walls and getting out. But the railroad came through this valley, purely a freight road, because it tapped the richest coal region around in the country, the famous Connellsville 7-foot vein of coal, and wonderful cooking coal. And the trains that came along there were only hauling out coke, because they converted the coal into coke before they took it away from the mine. This railroad had not been there in my youth, and it narrowed the valley, it abolished the island, and it produced a situation where floods became prevalent, because there was no longer the width of the stream to carry the water that there had been. And it made the basement of our house, which had the kitchen and several nice rooms, unusable, except at intervals between floods, and it could no longer be used as a kitchen. This again offered quite interesting things, and I remember my father, who was always putting his finger into new things when he saw them advertised or on display, coming home with the first receipt and mixers for making root beer. My mother was always protesting against these performances of his, but we made a trial lot of root beer. It was terrible. Nobody could drink it. The family all liked beer. I didn't, never have. And we had a great many beer bottles. In those days, they had a rubber stopper on a swing that put it in, and you pushed down one side and clamped it in the bottle. So we used these bottles for this root beer, which we couldn't drink, and it stood there. And then accidentally, about 6 months later, Andy and I found out that this was delicious to the taste. So we opened up a bar in the cellar. We sold corn silk cigars, and we sold beer, and we had the whole town in our cellar. My father came home one day and found this affair going on at full speed, and he went into the cellar and he sampled the root beer, and he seized the whole issue, because we found it had aged and was now really delicious. And we went out of action as bartenders. We regretted this bitterly. Then we got into a development of game chickens. The large game chickens, of which the black-breasted red was our favorite, as it had been in the Bantam chickens. And we had these chickens pitted by the bartender, George Gadd, who was quite a friend of our youth, and his blacksmith shop was our club, as it were. If one of us would pull the bellows, then the rest of us could sit there and talk and listen to the other talk. And this shop, blacksmith shop, faced on a great cobblestone square, which was the inner square of an inn which had persisted from the days of the earliest development in Uniontown. I'll interrupt this story to explain that, being on the national pike, this inn was used by all the great of those days who went to the West, and almost every prominent man of the West and the part of the South would come through Uniontown, because it is across the mountain and you had to take a rest, either coming or going, at Uniontown. So this inn was built in this old-fashioned way, and had this great cobblestone square, of which the blacksmith shop was a part, of which the butchery, where they killed the hogs in the fall, where we flocked around to get the bladders for footballs, as it were, and the granaries and other things, fronted on it. I remember when I was given a welcome in Uniontown after I was made chief of staff, and I hadn't been there for years. I found the hotel was built on the side of the square, and where I was sitting at the table was identified as one side, which had no buildings on it. And they crossed the room from me. My host identified the location of George Gadd's blacksmith shop, of the butchery place, and of other prominent points in this square from the days of the coaching on the National Pike. It also, I was sitting back to the alley where my sister in our young days found me playing hooky from school and went home and told on me. She denies that now, but that was the fact of the day, and it was a very painful interlude. I will go a little further. I had to make a speech. I had just been chief of staff a few weeks. They were all concerned about the war which had just developed in Europe on the 1st of September, and the press, of course, would immediately surround me. I wished to make no statement, and yet I knew I would have to say something, and some of the press men came on from Pittsburgh, and I beat one from Philadelphia. It was my first introduction to that sort of thing. I had identified where I was sitting with the old square before I got up, and searching around for something that might be of possible interest and to save me from talking about the European situation, of which I knew little in detail at that time, and which I was going to be so intimately connected as the days developed, I decided to identify the relationship of where we were to the days of my youth. And I recall that the first explanation I gave was singling out a lady in a red dress, evening dress, and I called all their attention to that. There were about 400 people in the room, and explained that that was the site of George Gadd's blacksmith shop. And then there was a lady in another colored dress a little further up the line, and she was sitting where they butchered the hogs in the fall and where we assembled to get the bladders. Now, I remember my stepdaughter and Mrs. Marshall were with me at this time, and she was very much embarrassed by my talking about bladders and sort of shrank in insignificance when I got to that part of the tale. But I could identify things all around the square with my youth, and now it was in this lovely dining room of a new hotel built on the site of this old tavern, which had sheltered Andrew Jackson and any number of the prominent characters of that day who traveled over the National Pike to get to the Ohio River and down to the Mississippi. The schools in the town for children of my associates began first, the earliest form of the school, by Miss Thompson, who was an old maid that ran this school. And it was a very bitter period to me because I never could do anything at all well. I only had one great struggle. I was very much taken with a young lady who now lives somewhat near here, matter of fact, in Richmond. And she was quite brilliant by comparison with me. And she stood at the head of the line in the spelling bee that occurred every day. So I made my first superhuman effort and worked up the line of the spellers in order to be close to her and win her respect. And I got up to next to the top and fell down the same day and went to the bottom, and I never tried again, and I still spell in a very fantastic manner. My only consolation is both my wife and my stepdaughter spell as badly, if not worse, than I do. But I'm rather a one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind when it comes to that. In this life of Uniontown, I saw what was, I guess you might call, the end of an era, because there's a very simple life and a very charming life, and had a long history behind it. The families there went back to the days of George Washington and his farm, which was nearby, and the coal and coke oven plant that my father ran was right across from the Washington farm. And that plant that my father operated was, I think, originally purchased by Gist, who was the guide for Washington when he made his first famous trip to see the Indians, to see the French, up near Lake Erie, north of Fort Duquesne, which is now Pittsburgh. The Braddock Trail ran through the near to this farm, and my father pointed out these historical facts to me And as a matter of fact, in our hunting, which he frequently took me on, particularly for pheasant, which were really grouse, we would follow the Braddock Trail, which remained to a large extent a clearing with a tract of green covering of grass on it, because the pheasant would often land into their flights in this clearing. And we could work with the dog pretty well there. So I became familiar with long strips of the Braddock Trail. On this trail, about 7 or 8 miles from home, was the site of Braddock's grave. When they were building the national road through, they dug up his grave and identified it by the brass button, and skeleton, and other things there. And they reinterred him close by in a very picturesque little plot. I don't think it was over 50 yards square. It had these little pine trees in it, and had his grave with a very small headstone. In fact, I don't remember what the grave looked like. But we would go out in that vicinity to picnic, and this little white fence had a flat board top, and we could sit on the fence. And I had lots of my early courtships, efforts were made sitting on that fence on a moonlight night after one of these picnic suppers in the mountain. Now, just a few miles beyond Braddock's grave was Fort Necessity, where Washington had to surrender his force, though he did it with the honors of war, and retained his weapons, and marched off when he was outnumbered by the French and Indians. That has now been built up into quite an impressive fort. But in my day, there was just a slight ridge in the field which showed where the entrenchment had been, which my father showed to me when I was about 7 years old. I went to the dedication of the new markers, the rebuilt fort, not so long ago. And they'd identified exactly where the fort was by finding, well beneath the surface, the lower end of the logs which formed the palisade, because they'd been preserved by the dampness of the soil, which was next to a stream, which flooded frequently. And now you can see this same replica of the fort at Fort Necessity, which is just a trifle beyond Braddock's grave. So these are all old places to me of my youth. And my father was very much interested in history, and he was interested in telling and showing me these factors. I always thought it was tragic, the fact that none of this was included in our schooling. I went through the public school, not through the public school, it wasn't good enough, but I went through part of it, and nowhere was I taught anything of what had happened in what was a remarkably historic region. There was a creek ran through the town, was discolored by the sulfur from the mines. At Redstone Creek. I guess it's always been somewhat discolored, and it ran a short distance of, I'll say, 10 or 12 miles into the Monongahela River, which was largely navigable as far as Pittsburgh, about 35 miles from there. And this again was the scene of very historic affairs. At Williamsburg at this time, there was a meeting of very famous characters. I've forgotten who was governor of Virginia at the time, but I know George Mason was one of them, and I think Alexander Hamilton. Anyway, there were three or four very famous characters, and they had a meeting to decide what to do about the fact that the English were established on the Mississippi River next to what is now Illinois, at Kaskaskia. That is pretty far south of Detroit, which was the English headquarters of that day. The French had held it, and the English had taken it over. And this group of men, the governor of Virginia and other state officials, felt that something had to be done. And their decision is rather interesting because it's so brief, and it shows the extreme simplicity of organizing an army in that period. All you had to do is take the rifle down from the nails or deer horns across the fireplace. You don't have to. I was speaking of the ease with which an expedition could be organized if it was local in a sense. You didn't have to cross the water. You took your rifle down off over the mantelpiece and went to war. Well, the concentration the organization, rather, of the force was directed, and a very famous leader was selected, whose name I forget at the moment, but which I will think of later. He organized these men there, and they were to go out to Kaskaskia. They went to the vicinity of Fort Duquesne, got a little better organized there, and went down the Ohio River, and finally left the river and went overland in order to effect surprise to Illinois, or what was then Virginia, and made a very difficult march to Kaskaskia. And there they surprised the British garrison. They were having a party. There are many illustrations of this frequently on calendars, where the Indians are lying around the outer rim of the room, and they're dancing in the middle. And this famous leader was coming in a very dramatic battle cry demanded the surrender. They found the actual British commander in bed with his wife, and Kaskaskia was surrendered to the this expedition. George Rogers Clark is the man I'm trying to think of. And then Clark turned around and went back to oust, to take over from the French Vincennes, which is now in Indiana, and had a terrific march through the swamps in order to get there. But that is the way this phase of the struggle went up, which started on Redstone Creek at my home. Later, there was another expedition, equally historic, and much more determining in its results. We were in distress by the British backing up the Indians, or utilizing Indians, and the country, which was the Northwest Territory at that time, largely Ohio and Indiana, had a strong Indian garrison. The Washington sent his first expedition out, which was General, well, I've forgotten that name, but you can look it up. And he gave him particular advice, Washington did, this commander, about avoiding surprise by the Indians. That is quite clearly accounted for in history, though it may be that the Washington enthusiasts thought up a good bit of it after the event occurred. However, I have no reason for saying that. Anyway, this expedition went out and was ambushed in a terrible massacre in what is now Ohio, which greatly shocked Washington, and he's attributed with a display of anger when he received the commander. He Washington, immediately turned to find a commander who could manage this thing. And he selected Anthony Wayne. And this expedition is very interesting for the reason that Mad Anthony didn't seem to be exactly the proper nickname for him, because he was the most careful man and one of the best organizers that I've come across in early history. He again organized his force, its beginnings, near Redstone Creek in the Monongahela River, and paused below Fort Duquesne, now Pittsburgh, for quite a long time to discipline these fellows, which is a very difficult thing to do with the old frontiersmen, who were the epitome of independence and individuality. Finally, they left there after some months. I think they wintered there. And then they went down the Ohio, and they paused at the falls of the Ohio, which I believe is Cincinnati, where a volunteer regiment of fine shots, volunteers, from Kentucky was to join them. They waited there quite a while and then went on down and cut in from the river to, I think it's Greenville, it's Green something, where he went ahead with his further organization, getting these men into shape. This is most unusual, because most of those volunteer organizations organized today and went to battle tomorrow. He then built an advance post at what's called Fort Defiance, and I think still is Fort Defiance, is on the Pennsylvania Railroad between New York and Chicago. or Pittsburgh and Chicago. He sent a fairly good-sized force there, and they were attacked by the Indians in considerable force, and the British may have been with them. I don't recall that. And they drove off this force successfully. In other words, they blooded the command, which he thought was quite necessary. He then brought more of them up to Fort Necessity, and finally moved out. But I must say before this, though this is not about Uniontown, though this had its beginnings near there, a very remarkable thing had taken place. The chief, whose name I've forgotten, I'll call him Little Chief, or Green Kettle, or something of that sort, had adopted a son. And this son was a white boy captured when he was 6 years old. And he'd become the adopted son of the chief, and he'd become the sub-chief of the tribe. And, of course, that made him a very valuable person if he could get into the Americans' hands, the American being the white man. But he was so shocked with this scene of all these bodies of white men at the time of this massacre. I think it was Sinclair was massacred there at the time of this massacre, that he left Little Chief and went over to the white man's affairs. So when Anthony Wayne was organizing the force, this man came in and offered his services as a scout. And he, of course, became the chief scout. And, of course, he was a scout without really parallel because he was brought up in the Indian training, which is so wonderful for a woodsman. And he knew all about them because he'd been sub-chief of the tribe. And now he was the chief scout for Anthony Wayne's force. Anthony Wayne's people moved out from Fort Defiance and encountered the British and largely Indians in the what's known as the Battle of Fallen Timber, where these huge trees were blown down by a hurricane of that early day and defeated them completely, and moved on toward Detroit. There they did not attempt to assault the fort, because that would have been rather difficult to do, and also it had something to do with diplomacy of that day. But they put out all of the British trappers and everything who lived outside the fort. Then they retired into Indiana and destroyed some thousands of acres of corn, because that was a great corn crop there that the Indians raised for the winter. Then they retired to Greenville or wherever this was, and dominated the whole region. The Indian chief came there with some of his sub-chiefs, and they had a meeting with Anthony Wayne, and they had to parley with him in his favor because he dominated the whole region. Among the things that he determined upon, which they had to concede, was a tract of land where the Chicago, what is now called the Chicago River, empties into Lake Michigan, because that was a means of connection between the Illinois River and the Mississippi and New Orleans, and was going to have a great value because of that factor. And that is the origin of Chicago. That is the site of Chicago and its build-up by the white men of that period. Afterwards, this chief scout, this Indian-trained boy, played a dramatic part in the final massacre of the Americans, under whose commander had given up, who destroyed all his munitions of war. And this fellow, this chief scout, who had for some time been out in Michigan, in Indiana, in the wilderness, on some sort of a civil job, in relation to the Indians, I think, and he took command of the advance guard in this desperate situation, which he wholly disapproved of, and near the site of what was the social center of Chicago those days, they met the Indians, who had promised them a safe exit, and he died fighting in the advance guard, and he rode with his face painted black, which is the custom of the Indians when you're on a desperate mission from which you have no hope, really, of surviving. This street in Chicago that is parallels LaSalle Street, Wells Street, is named for that man. Now to go back to Uniontown, which I mentioned because of its proximity to these things. Another place of my youth which I enjoyed was the fishing, trout fishing, and in the streams in the mountain. And the one stream in particular, which rose out of a deep ravine in the mountains, rose at the site of Washington's encounter at the opening of the French and Indian War, where the first shot was fired there, which was literally hurled around the war of the world of those days, upset the thrones in Europe, and pretty much changed the face of political Europe. I'm sorry I can't remember the name of this Frenchman who was ambushed here by Washington, though it is familiar to me as the name of the street in front of our house, but I'll remember it later and insert it for your use, or you can find it in any history. Anyway, Washington surprised the French patrol commander, and he was killed as well as his men. And that was used against Washington very much by the French at this period. And that was where we started our trout fishing. Jumonville. Jumonville's grave is marked with a pile of stones, which the occasional visitor puts in place. And in those days, no tourists got anywhere near the place. And only those rather familiar with the mountains there would go into it, largely fishermen, like my chum and myself. But the story of Jumonville was recited to me by my father. And nearby was the scene of Washington's council of war with an Indian chief who was friendly to the Americans or English of that day. So there was a great deal of history, and very, very important history was written in that vicinity. And there was this great life of the nation which flowed through the National Pike and stopped overnight at the inn just two blocks beyond the house that I lived in as a boy. In looking over the account of that inn, I think almost everybody in the federal government from the West, the near West, and the South spent a night in that inn. And historically, you might say the life of the nation, short of New York, Boston, Baltimore, places like that in the East, flowed through that particular town. I remember rather amusingly that my first wife's mother, who was a very ardent Virginian of an old, old Virginia family, one of her progenitors was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and was one of the leaders in Williamsburg, and who's buried at the head of the aisle in the chapel there, which is always visited with historic interest. She was a very ardent Virginian, and she thought that the name Uniontown sounded rather common, and she was rather ashamed of where I came from. And it wasn't until Beveridge's Life of John Marshall came out, with having no relation to me, which disclosed the fact that Uniontown was a far older settlement than her home in Lexington, Virginia. And it had been in Washington's day and before that. And the name Union came from two so-called townships of that day were united. And there were many old families there who had persisted through these years and formed a very exclusive community, which my father came up to after the Civil War in a position with the iron furnaces nearby. I repeat again that I hardly know just what trail to follow. I've said once that I thought this was rather the end of an era in the town life that was presented. It was very attractive. It was very simple. And I thought the people were very, very kindly. They had old families, very old, that went back to almost to Washington's day. And in fact, it did go back to his day. And It had its record of good fighting men in the Civil War, and it had its men that had gone to the Mexican War, and then what was much more exciting to me, it had a few bandits in the mountain, and that was right after Jesse James and that period, and of course that excited me tremendously. And I remember when they had one surrounded up in the mountains, I wanted very much to go, and my father wanted to go, and my mother put a stopper to that. But they finally got the fella, or fellows, because it was a whole gang. And this is certainly out of place as to the timing element, but that reminds me of an amusing experience I had. The Geological Survey came through that region, completing its mapping. And after the basis of the mapping first had to be the triangulation stations, and then came the levels, the precise level run through to give the carry the exact elevations above sea level from the sea level, and then the local level lines, which were not so exact, but were comparatively exact as we would understand it, but they wouldn't carry their error on through long distances, such as the great baseline based on the triangulation. Well, I got a job as an assistant to a man who ran the levels, the local levels, and it was largely done with the stadia rod, which I carried, and he ran the transit. That was my first real close-up of engineering, though it was a very simple form. And I enjoyed this very much in the summer. And one night, we reached the peak of that range of the Chestnut Ridge of the mountains and stayed overnight with this mountain family. There was no other place anywhere near them. And this mountaineer was an old dominant character. And as I recall, he had two married daughters and one married son, and his wife and himself. And of course, they had some babies. And we all slept in the same room. We slept on the floor, my level man and myself. And I don't know what their arrangement of beds was, but they couldn't have had more than two or three. But that put the whole family away there. They were very generous to us, and we accepted their hospitality very gratefully, and were very happy to have this opportunity for rest. But they had a greatly valued old clock, a standing clock, and it seemed to me that it struck the hour about every 5 or 10 minutes. And I had a little trouble getting to sleep because I wasn't used to sleeping on the floor, and I couldn't dig a place for my hips. And while I was young and not too heavy, nevertheless, it was pretty uncomfortable. But the thing that amused me was that the life of the family under these circumstances, they didn't have much argument because they went to sleep very promptly. But they would all stir around, of course, have to wake me up. And then they woke me up very early so that I would have the private privilege of a bath in the horse trough. And that was outside. Altogether, it was a very funny night, particularly with this clock, which seemed to me struck very, very frequent intervals. Something happened. It's a very tiny thing to tell here, but I never quite understood it. Like all young fellows of that age, I was apt to lose the intensity of purpose in the job, which my level man would not. He was an older man. He must have been about 35. And several times he had to correct me from being absent-minded and not holding the stadia rod correctly for him to read. And on one of these occasions, I sought an excuse, as a boy always does, and I told him I was looking at that bird on the fence, which, as I recall, was a swallow. Well, he stopped in a rather scathing tone to suggest, "What about that bird on the fence?" And without any real idea of what was happening or why I was doing it, and certainly no premonition of the result, I walked over to the fence and picked up this swallow. He wasn't wounded. He didn't fly. And I picked him up. And that paralyzed my surveyor friend, and then I turned him loose and he flew off. And he thought I had some mysterious quality which enabled me to handle birds, but I never had a similar occurrence in my life. But it dug me out of that embarrassment of being rather asleep on the job. Now, in this mountain country, I would say Andy and I fished, explored, hunted grouse, which we call pheasant, and generally disported ourselves in the most entertaining and educational way. And I remember afterwards, years and years afterwards, when I was at General Pershing in Washington, at a dance at the Chevy Chase Club, which occurred every Saturday night, a very lovely woman was sitting on the sidelines, and she spoke to me. Well, I didn't know her at all, but I responded by walking over and introducing myself. And she introduced herself and was Lillian Russell. She'd married to a Pittsburgher at that time. Of course, she's a woman well up in years now. And she said, was good enough to say she admired my dancing, and she's sorry she had passed the dancing age, and she'd like to meet me. Well, I said, of course, I was greatly honored to meet her. But I said, as a matter of fact, I met you years ago. And I said, of course, you've met thousands of people. Just barely registered on your mind, but you made an indelible impression on them. Well, she said, where did you meet me? Well, I said, I came in from fishing one day up in the mountains where a man from Pittsburgh had a rather large estate. And the lower end of his estate, which was almost a virgin forest, had one of our good trout streams in it. And we got in there, without his permission, incidentally, and fished there. And we came out on the National Pike right at the foot of one of the ridges of the mountain. And there, sitting on horses on the other side of the fence, by walking over and introducing myself. And she introduced herself and was Lillian Russell. She'd married to a Pittsburgher at that time. Of course, she's a woman well up in years now. And she said, was good enough to say she admired my dancing, and she's sorry she had passed the dancing age, and she'd like to meet me. Well, I said, of course, I was greatly honored to meet her. But I said, as a matter of fact, I met you years ago. And I said, of course, you've met thousands of people. Just barely registered on your mind, but you made an indelible impression on them. Well, she said, where did you meet me? Well, I said, I came in from fishing one day up in the mountains where a man from Pittsburgh had a rather large estate. And the lower end of his estate, which was almost a virgin forest, had one of our good trout streams in it. And we got in there, without his permission, incidentally, and fished there. And we came out on the National Pike right at the foot of one of the ridges of the mountain. And there, sitting on horses on the other side of the fence, were these two very lovely women, one in particular, and that was you, Lillian Russell. And you asked us what the country like was around there and where they might ride. And I told you, and I've never forgotten that. At that time, you were appearing in one of your earliest light operas. I believe it was called The Mountaineer. And you were the most famous, beautiful woman in America. And she was very much interested in my recollection and finally identified where the place was and in a faint way identified the place. She'd been left alone with her companion because the host had to rush off to Pittsburgh in connection with his coal interest, because he of that day was what was called a coal baron. But I'd never forgotten meeting her out on the road when we were in one of our fishing things. Now, in connection with our bantam, with our fighting chickens, as I say, the man in the barber shop, in the blacksmith shop, pitted our birds for us and was our boon companion and was the president of our club, which was the blacksmith shop. We took our chickens to a main, as they call them, up in the mountains, where a lot of Pittsburgh sports, 75 miles away, were to be present. And that attracted us because we had good chickens. We'd gotten the eggs from Georgia and the Georgia Reds and things of that sort. And we really had very good chickens. But we couldn't pit them ourselves, and they would not have permitted us to enter the ring in an affair of this kind. So George Gadd had to be our performer. And we took the horse and got up in the mountain where this main was to be, and was very much in defiance of law of that day. So we hitched the horse far remote from the pit where the, as we call it, where the chickens were to be fought. And there were quite a number of sports. I can't remember. Of course, I would think it was a larger number than they actually were, but I would say there were 40 or 50 men, and very heavy bedding. We wanted to get the horse as far away from the activities as possible and as far away from the other horses as possible. And then we went to attend the main. And we were squatted on.